emotion on the human side which will make this a transition possible. And he states it in very uncompromising terms, as we say that, as he says, there would be necessary to a total submission and surrender of the lower consciousness, a cessation of its insistence, a will in it for its separate law of action to be completely annulled by transformation and lose all rights over our being. So these two conditions, on the one hand, an intervention from above, and on the other, an active will in the lower consciousness to cede to a higher working, would be necessary for a relatively smooth and quick passage out of the ignorance into the condition he's talking about, he's introducing earlier, which are essentially, to go back to the basics of this paragraph, the ascent to the supermind, and essentially, if you relate it to the previous paragraph chapter, the triple transformation is concerned with the emergence into the two transformations beyond the psychic transformation, that is the overmental and the supramental phases. So in those paragraphs that follow, Sri Aurobindo resumes his panoramic view of the evolution, where first he begins by talking about what one might call the development of a yogic consciousness, which is something within us that develops gradually greater mastery over nature. And as that mastery increases, we find that we become attuned to another kind of nature, a cosmic nature, which in a way opens up the laws of the overmind and makes us into participants in action. So in dealing with that, he undertakes this panoramic journey of evolution, as I said, showing how our nature has moved to a certain phase wherein the human being, a certain degree of relatively advanced consciousness has made its appearance, and how that consciousness, what constitutes the consciousness. There are two major factors that make that consciousness into something which has a greater sense of mastery over nature. One is the power of intelligence, and the other is the power of will. Power of intelligence allows us to perceive the laws of nature, and yet this is only a half clouded perception of the laws of nature, a groping and blinded journey from ignorance towards understanding or knowledge. On the other hand, power of will is something which is, again, you know, I mean, inherent to it is some sort of an intuition of what is called free will, and yet it knows that it is hardly free. So it is this compromised will and this ambiguous intelligence, knowledge, with which the human being emerges into consciousness. Sri Aurobindo points that out and says, what is lacking? And the very fact that these are felt as lacks by human beings implies that in some sense we are driven by a relationship with the future which tries to maximize these lacks in terms of gains. Can we have greater knowledge, greater seeing, greater understanding? And on the other hand, can we have a greater will, a more omnipotent will that has control over the forces of nature? Initially, these tendencies take on an egoistic sort of stand, and an individualistic, separatist and egoistic stands, because that is the condition of our being. We start from a sense of being, a sense of existence in which we are separated from others. And the drive for greater knowledge and greater will is experienced within this separative condition. This is what gives it a certain egoistic stand. However, Sri Aurobindo points out that this stamp itself is something which drives towards a greater emergence of consciousness. I read from that paragraph, there is not as yet, in human mind there is the first appearance of an observing intelligence that regards what is being done and of a will and choice that have become conscious. But the consciousness is still limited and superficial. The knowledge also is limited and imperfect. It is a partial intelligence, a half understanding, groping and empirical in great part. Or if rational, then rational by constructions, theories, formulas. There is not as yet a luminous seeing which knows things by a direct grasp and arranges them with a spontaneous precision according to the seeing, according to the scheme of their inherent truth. In fact, this sentence itself is something that is contested at its very root by our self-understanding as human beings. Is it even possible for human beings to bridge the gulf between subject and object? Do we have any access to what it is that we are, in the middle of in terms of cosmos? Or are we doomed to only make approximations and make the best of a nature that we'll never understand? This is in fact one of the major conundrums of philosophy. And Sri Aurobindo is pointing to the fact that there is a certain sense or an intuition that there is a bridge exists, whereby instead of groping to understand what surrounds us and trying to build constructions by which we can have some control over what surrounds us, we can arrive at a perception of the laws that surround us and the unity with the will that is bringing things into manifestation. So that luminous seeing, which knows things by direct grasp and arranges them with a spontaneous precision according to the seeing and according to the scheme of their inherent truth, points to an inherent sort of seeing and will, which belongs to the cosmic Purusha. So this is exactly what we are moving towards. So although there is a certain element of instinct and intuition and insight which have some beginning of this power, the normal character of human intelligence is an inquiring reason or reflective thought which observes, supposes, infers, concludes, arrives by labor at a constructed truth, constructed scheme of knowledge, deliberately arranged action of its own making. So this is the situation. And then the next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo points out how this is evidently not satisfactory. This is what marks the discontent of the human being at its very base. And from this, he points to the fact that there is a evolution possible in the individual in which this intuition of the seeing and will of nature becomes part of our own activity. It proceeds first by a kind of participation, by a being in harmony, being in tune with such a seeing and will, and it ends by a union and an identity with such a seeing and will. I think that is where we stand right now, and the next paragraph will take us further.
Vishishtha, I got to go somewhere urgently. I'm logging off right now.
Yeah, I'll sort of start the class in a second.
Okay.
Okay. a harmonious other world in which an intuitive mental intelligence of this kind and its control would be the rule is conceivable. But in our plane of being, owing to the original intention and past history of the evolutionary plan, such a rule and control could with difficulty be stable.
We can't hear you, Sean. Are you muted?
Oh, sorry. Let me just... and I have a conversation. Yeah, can you hear me now?
Sure, I can. I can hear you.
A harmonious other world in which an intuitive mental intelligence of this kind and its control would be the rule is conceivable. But in our plane of being, owing to the original intention and past history of the evolutionary plan, such a rule and control could with difficulty be stabilized, and it is not likely that it could be complete, final, and definitive. For an intuitive mentality intervening in a mixed mental, vital, physical consciousness would normally be forced to undergo a mixture with inferior stuff of consciousness already evolved. In order to act on it, it would have to enter into it, and entering in it would get entangled in it, penetrated by it, affected by the separative and partial character of our mind's action and the limitation and restrictive force of the ignorance. The action of intuitive intelligence is keen and luminous enough to penetrate and modify, but not large and whole enough to swallow up into itself and abolish the mass of the ignorance and inconscience. It could not effect an entire transformation of the whole consciousness into its own stuff and power. Still, even in our present state, a participation of a kind is there, and our normal intelligence is sufficiently awake for the universal conscious force to work through it and allow the intelligence and will to exercise a certain amount of direction of inner and outer consciousness, fumbling enough and at every moment dogged by error, capable only of a limited effect and power, not commensurate with the larger totality of our vast operations. In the evolution towards supernature, this initial power of conscious participation in the universal working would enlarge in the individual into a more and more intimate and would enlarge in the individual into a more and more intimate and extended vision of her workings in himself, a sensitive perception of the course she was taking, a growing undertaking or understanding or intuitive idea of the methods that had to be followed for a more rapid and more conscious self-evolution. As his inner psychic or occult inner mental being came more to the front, there would be a strengthened power of choice, of sanction, a beginning of authentic free will, which would grow more and more effective. But this free will would be mostly in relation to his own workings of nature. It would mean only a freer, fuller, and more immediately perceptive control of the motions of his own being. Even there, it could not be at first completely free, so long as it was imprisoned in the limits created by its own formations or combated by imperfection due to a mixture of the old and the new consciousness. Still, there would be an increasing mastery and knowledge and an opening to a higher being and a higher nature.
Again, Sri Aurobindo is taking up what he has hinted at before, which is the difficulty of such an intuitive consciousness maintaining itself in any purity in our mixed condition. So here, just as he has talked about new principles emerging in the ignorance, the problem of the emergence of an intuitive mind is that it will immediately be dogged by the kind of mixture that everything is subject to in the ignorance. The emergence of new powers of consciousness in the ignorance, so long as they belong to the ignorance, is okay, and as he has pointed out, it is sufficient for a working which is a pressure from above and a kind of a subliminal growth from within to establish it. But if we are talking of a truth principle, if whatever power of a truth principle tries to enter into this particular mixture will be subjected to the powers of ignorance and will have to act or work according to the powers of ignorance. An intuitive mentality is therefore, you know, subject to two kinds of problems. One of the problems is that it is going to immediately be confronted by mixture. That mixture brings confusion. And confusion makes it more and more difficult, given the amount of darkness or ignorance in the lower ranges of consciousness, to extricate it from the actions of the ignorance. Particularly at the level of vital and material consciousness, intuitions become very, very compromised because of this. The second kind of problem arises from the separative ego. Separative ego is also a function of the development of individuality within the ignorance. And as a result, whatever intuitive consciousness enters into this is also going to be co-opted by the power of ego or of separativeness for its own self-interest. The cosmic harmony to which intuitive consciousness belongs would in some way or the other get distorted and turned into, you know, some sort of self-serving function. So Sri Aurobindo points out that though it is possible to conceive of a power of intuitive consciousness in which the human being is in harmony with a higher Purusha, but independent, in some other world, in our world, either we have to have it all or we don't have anything. In this kind of halfway house of an intuitive consciousness, we can achieve a certain degree of truth, but it is always going to be too compromised to have any lasting value on a universal level, even on an individual level, for that matter. At the sort of lower levels of consciousness, it's interesting that the intuitive consciousness is given the image of lightning. Lightning is the image by which it is symboled, and that's the reason why in the Vedas it is as the lightnings of Indra, the lord of the overmind, that the intuitive consciousness is symboled. Sri Aurobindo also is talking about intuitive consciousness because when we speak of the higher ranges of cosmic mind, it is only at that level that some truth consciousness can emerge in its purity. Lightnings light up individual ranges of ground. They can't light up cosmic ranges of ground. It is only by adding these flashes of lightning, if there is a sincerity in the individual, that consciousness can expand itself towards the cosmic. Now, this is the problem that he points out. Though there is a certain content of truth, that's, say for example, the mystic statements of the Upanishads are supposed to come from this intuitive mind or this intuition, as Sri Aurobindo calls it, plane of intuition. But the problem is that they illuminate in a subjective manner, and that illumination is not sufficiently large to overcome the totality. That's why it has to maintain itself in a secret language, in a secret domain, secretive domain. What he points out is that it is keen and luminous to penetrate and modify, but not large and whole to swallow into itself and abolish the mass of the ignorance. This is a very important distinction. That's why it is the beginning of an emergence into truth, but it is not a certain power of truth which can actually transform. This is why Sri Aurobindo points to the fact that none of these cosmic ranges of mind can transform the lower part, you know, aspects of the avidya, of ignorant consciousness, which in some sense is masked with ignorance. So he says that as this increases, so this is nevertheless, it's a very important power. There is no doubt that this transition, a necessary transition, development of this particular power of consciousness is that which yields for us a much greater power, both of intelligence as well as of will, of the freedom of will. Mankind starts experiencing what it means to have a free will only with the beginning of the emergence of intuitive mind. This is so because before that, whatever we call will or free will is completely conditioned by ignorance. At this point, we start realizing that. That realization itself is the beginning of the understanding of freedom in will. We also realize that the will at this point is still not free. Again, it is the difference between the limited and the individual and the cosmic. There is a certain degree of freedom by which one can have control over the individual domain, but it is certainly not enough either to have control over the lower aspects of the individual consciousness or any aspect of the cosmic consciousness. So this is a transitional stage that Sri Aurobindo is pointing out. But still, as he says, there would be an increasing mastery in knowledge and an opening to a higher being and a higher nature.
In this context, when we say, you know, it wouldn't be possible in our world, but it would be possible in another world, what do we mean by world here?
Okay, a world is basically, when we use the word world, we are talking about a set of relations between Purusha and Prakriti. That, I mean, at a cosmic level, mm-hmm. That is, that a manifestation may occur with many beings in it who all follow a certain set of relations between Purusha and Prakriti. That set of relations is not necessarily a material set of relations or only a material set of relations. These may be a set of relations in mind, these may be a set of relations in the life aspect, etc. But whatever kind of multiplicity may follow certain laws that mediate between a certain power of knowledge and power of will and a certain action that would constitute a world.
So when we say that, right, those relations, are they mutable at all, or is it the case that once a world is formed, then those relations are fixed, and while you may move in a certain range, outside of that range there is no movement in those set of relations? Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So that's exactly the point that he's making here, that one can conceive of such a static world, a world in which a set of relations which has a range within which things move but are predictable. There is a certain stabilization of the relations over there. Mm-hmm. But the problem with our world is that there is no such range. This is the point that he is making again and again. An evolutionary world does not lend itself to a predictable range of relations between Purusha and Prakriti. As a result, any particular set of such relations falls into a certain condition of ambiguity. That's where the whole idea of falling comes in. It drops into a certain, that's where the dropping into the ocean, as it were, is falling into an ocean in which its law is immediately seen as just a relative thing, no longer having any primacy and immediately subject to mixture.
So in our world, even at the level of the overmind, the set of relations that would exist. So that also would be part of our world, even though it's an ignorance. But only past that would it become that it's outside the bound of our the relations possible in this world. Is that correct?
Yeah, when we say relations possible in the in this world, at this point we can only talk about what is already manifest. And as he's pointing out, even overmind is not really manifest in our world, so to say.
Uh-huh.
Though it is manifesting our world. So we may say that in our world, whatever powers have already emerged into consciousness is what constitutes the set of relations of our world. That includes matter, life, and a rather limited range of mind. Moving from our present condition of mind towards an intuitive mind, that would be about the range of our world, so to say.
Thank you, Devashishna.
So, can we say that it's a materialization thing, right? That it's, spirit's materialization into matter, that is only in our world, and as a result, all other worlds we can sort of attribute it to some kind of psychological layer.
We may conceive also of a kind of material world which does not change. That is a material world in which evolution of consciousness does not take place. So too we may conceive of what are known as the hell worlds, in other words, vital worlds, in which a certain set of relations between Purusha and Prakriti are fixed. So, our world would include a material world in which consciousness has the power of challenging the set of relations that are established and introduce new relations between Purusha and Prakriti, as you say, in a kind of a materialization of spirit and a spiritualization of matter.
I mean, are they as comprehensive as our world, or is it something, a state of consciousness, which is defined as a being or a world?
Yeah, but from a certain point of view, everything is a state of consciousness. Even matter is a state of consciousness. So, in the material world, it's just a certain perception of chit.
Yes, but in our world, so many, so many interventions and so many different kind of, sort of act of creation took place. As a result, when we perceive reality, it has many components, like not just one. So that is when, we call it like, it's very, when we can match with, sort of description from all directions, we say it is a comprehensive description. So that's from that point of view I was saying. It is our convention to think of reality as having many, directions of its description.
Yeah, so that is because our world is an evolutionary world and it encompasses all these various worlds in its journey. So, as one may speak of the relations between Purusha and Prakriti in our world as relations marked by the double action of a, materialization of a spirit and a spiritualization of matter. In this double action, comprehensiveness arises as a property. Now, this comprehensiveness that has arisen as a property, however, is only partial. The true world in which comprehensiveness is a natural property is the supramental world. In supramental world, there is integral consciousness. In other words, the relation between Purusha and Prakriti includes all these other worlds that we are talking about in a harmonious fashion. These worlds, however, can separate themselves out and be independent worlds. And also, supermind can conceive of a certain world in which that comprehensive property becomes an emergent property, not something which is part of its intrinsic law. That would be our world.
So that reminds me of another way of saying. What I'm saying is that there's a hint of integral consciousness, though it is not present. So maybe that's what I'm talking about as comprehensiveness, which is unformed integral consciousness, not formed yet. There's a hint, nevertheless.
Yeah, exactly. That is what marks this world or our world is the intuition of an integral consciousness.
So that way we can say that our world is very different from all other worlds that we think of other than supramental world itself.
Yeah, indeed. Absolutely, that is true. That is exactly, one of the differentiating features between what we are calling our world and these worlds that he's talking about, including a world in which intuitive mentality can be free to express itself in its own way.
So, yeah, I mean, also in our, when we, no matter which, in which subject it is, when we speak of reality, we somewhere in our obscure somewhere part, we sort of assume that it is going to be unfathomable and it's endless, or it's something that is that has that hint of that integral description. So from that point of view, I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to think that to that kind of perception, all other worlds don't seem as real.
Yeah, you may say something. I mean, so the sense of reality, if that is something that you're trying to define in terms of this notion of integrality, yeah, I would agree with that. That is exactly why supermind is called real idea. Reality as manifestation. Whether the other world seem as real, you mentioned three things. You mentioned unfathomable, endless, and integral. Of the two, unfathomable and endless are properties of each of these worlds. Because ultimately, it is only Brahman that is being measured out in each of these worlds. There is a sense of the infinite in each of them. But there is not a sense of integrality. Maybe that is where the difference lies. And also, there is not a sense of evolution, which is a property of what you're calling the real world. So maybe reality is something that is related to what we are saying, including this power of integrality and the power of emergence of new properties at all times. That aspect of infinity, that is also an aspect of infinity, is not included in those other worlds.
Thank you. Yeah, the aspect of infinity is what I'm probably meant as infinity, because integral is something that is ultimately unfathomable. I mean, from that point of view, because it has so many directions. By the number of directions itself, it is infinite. Not just by the length of that depth, or length or depth, just by this possibility itself, it's infinite. I mean, by what I mean is that the number of dimensions itself is infinite.
Yeah.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Luis, would you like to read?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. our notion of free will is apt to be tainted with the excessive individualism of the human ego and to assume the figure of an independent will acting on its own isolated account in a complete liberty without any determination other than its own choice and single unrelated movement. This idea ignores the fact that our natural being is a part of cosmic nature and our spiritual being exists only by the supreme transcendence. Our total being can rise out of subjection to fact of present nature only by an identification with a greater truth and a greater nature. The will of the individual, even when completely free, could not act in an isolated independence because the individual being and nature are included in the universal being and nature and dependent on the all-overruling transcendence. There could indeed be, in the ascent, a dual line. On one line, the being could feel and behave as an independent self-existence, uniting itself with its own impersonal reality. It could, so self-conceived, act with a great force, but either this action would be still within a large frame of its past and present self-formation of power of nature, or else it would be the cosmic or supreme force that acted in it, and there would be no personal initiation of action, no sense, therefore, of individual free will, but only of an impersonal cosmic or supreme will or energy at its work. On the other line, the being would feel itself a spiritual instrument and so act as a power of the supreme being, limited in its workings only by the potencies of the supernature, which are without bounds or any restriction except its own truth and self-law and by the will in her. But in either case, there would be, as a condition of a freedom from the control of a mechanical action of nature forces, a submission to a greater conscious power or an acquiescent unity of the individual being with its intention and movement in his own and in the world's existence.
So, in this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo takes up the whole issue of free will. Now, human beings have an intuition of free will and a need for free will. That need comes because we feel that we are beings of will, but our will is constantly compromised and constrained. This sense of an imprisonment of the will, while having it in, you know, power of assertion, yet being constantly opposed or being subject to laws that don't agree with it, is something that gives us this notion of free will and the need for it. Now, this arises as a result of the fact that there is a duality between Purusha and Prakriti in the ignorance. Again, talking about worlds and the relations between Purusha and Prakriti in each world, the whole sphere of ignorance or avidya can be considered a world. What marks this world is the duality between Purusha and Prakriti. This duality is ultimately what makes the subjection of Purusha a power of emergence. Purusha feels that it is subject to Prakriti and feels that it needs to emerge. At the intermediate level of the human consciousness, this becomes a property of Prakriti itself. That's why within Prakriti, we feel that we need to have freedom of will. But as a property of Prakriti within the ignorance, this need for free will actually is tainted by the ego. This is how he begins that paragraph. This is the reason why whatever we understand by free will is not taking into account the fact that the individual will is an aspect of a cosmic working. What is the truth behind the need for free will is that individual Purusha wishes to be free of the action of Prakriti. The mechanical movements of Prakriti in the lower nature are something that we want to be free of. And in trying to be free of this, we emerge as Purusha. But once we emerge as Purusha, we also realize that we are agents in a cosmic working. In an individual way, we can have some control over our own nature. But it can't be a control which completely defies the universal nature. As Sri Aurobindo points out, that even if we go beyond Prakriti, beyond nature, cosmic nature, in our need for independence of will, we find ourselves determined by a higher nature, by Paraprakriti. If we are not part, if the will is not part of nature, all it can be is impotent. The will enters into a certain kind of quiescence of observation, sakshi, bhava. And something else acts, which is either the lower nature or the higher nature. Some cosmic will, which is not our own will. This is one of the lines of the development towards pre-will. That's what Sri Aurobindo points out towards the end. That there are two lines along which this movement towards pre-will may proceed. Both of them, and both may happen simultaneously. One is the seeking for freedom, which releases the Purusha and makes it free, in the sense that either it can decide not to act at all, or the will of past nature, the lower Prakriti, can continue acting, but it can feel free from it, or a higher nature, cosmic Purusha, can start working through it, and yet it can feel free from it. That is one line of the action or movement of free will. The other action of free will is becoming a channel of the higher nature. Now, this particular discussion, particularly towards the end, is what Sri Aurobindo elaborates to a great extent in the essays on the Gita, when he discusses Shara and Akshara Purusha. Shara Purusha is the mutable soul in man. That is the part of the being that is active, or that is the part of the Purusha that has accepted the action of nature so that it may act within it. Shara Purusha's fulfillment lies in surrender to the Paraprakriti, to a higher nature that may use it as an instrument and a channel for its own will. But there is another aspect of the Purusha or of the soul of man which moves towards complete independence. That in its fulfillment arrives at union with the cosmic Purusha. That union with the cosmic Purusha allows it to become a agent of the will of cosmic Purusha. So through identity. Identity with the cosmic Purusha in being, and a channeling of the cosmic Prakriti as an instrument, are the two fulfillments that he is talking about over here. This is the meaning of free will. Free will is not something which is what we understand it under the conditions of ego. Under conditions of ego, we strain against the bars of the prison. But once we emerge out of the condition of ego, our understanding of the freedom of free will completely changes. It is due to the duality of the relation between Purusha and Prakriti in the ignorance that there is an excessive strain towards the freedom of the Purusha, since it needs to master Prakriti. But in a higher condition, it realizes that Paraprakriti is nothing but the will of Supreme Purusha himself. There, the freedom of the will is subject to Paraprakriti and at the same time its master. Both master and slave. This is the paradoxical reality of the higher action of free will. This part is also carried in a very beautiful way in Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga when he discusses dasya or slavery or servitude. He's talking about being completely enslaved to the action of Paraprakriti, that being the highest condition of the action of will.
Devashisa, where does this come in synthesis of yoga again?
Oh, I was talking about Essays on the Gita, not Synthesis of Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Essays on the Gita, where he's talking about, about Kshara and Akshara Purusha.
Okay, thank
but
you.
It does come in the Synthesis of Yoga, because Synthesis of Yoga, as we were studying, relates to the record of yoga.
Sure.
And it comes in the chapters on Shakti, when he's talking about Dasya.
Thank you.
That's in the Yoga of Self-Perfection.
Yeah, the last book, okay. So in our current notion of, that is in the ignorance, when we think of a free will, it is implicitly, the unconscious aspiration there is the control of the Prakriti by the Purusha. Is that what you're saying? It's not simply the vital being having complete control over the rest of the being.
Yeah, actually, as you put it, what I was trying to say, if you remember, is that the need for free will first emerges in Prakriti itself. So there it is subject to ego. That's where, as you put it, the vital will wants control over the rest of the being, whether mental being or vital being or a mixture of the two.
Sure.
But that is also a lower understanding. That is what normal people understand by the word free will. You see, it is already a slavery to the automatisms of nature, but there is an excessive need to be a certain kind of a performer within that slavery. Now, behind it is another and deeper yearning, that is the yearning for the Purusha to be free of Prakriti.
Mm-hmm.
But that yearning also belongs, as it were, to the set of laws that determine Avidya. Even beyond that is the knowledge of the union between Purusha and Prakriti, and of the freedom, the simultaneous freedom and slavery of the will. Divine will is completely free, and yet it is completely enslaved to Paraprakriti's movement. This is possible because the two are one. See, that is, in a sense, the paradoxical condition of the emergence from avidya and entry into the vidya.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Devashishtha. Very useful. Because I think, so it's not simply that your first need or intuition of the ordinary consciousness is wrong, but even the second one is also not complete, that it's not comprehensive enough until we understand it as enslaved to the Paraprakriti, not just simply the Purusha exercising control over the Prakriti, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The search for the freedom of free will in the avidya enters an impasse with the Sakshi Bhava. Once the Purusha emerges, it becomes neutral and it becomes unable in its essence to initiate any action. That is the end of the state of avidya Purusha. That is what is known as Akshara Purusha. Akshara Purusha is also the condition of Jivatman at the borders of the ignorance. Now, in that condition, it cannot actually act. Purusha cannot act by itself. It cannot initiate any action, and it cannot actually master any action. That's why in that condition, there is only one particular, or maybe there are two particular avenues open to it. One is not to act at all. In other words, it impedes all action and being falls into quiescence. And the other is to allow Prakriti to continue acting but not to identify with it. That is the degree of mastery that it can know. Now, the emergence from that to a condition where it knows itself as Ishvara is also simultaneously a condition in which it knows itself to be the slave of Paraprakriti. See, that double condition, Ishvara and Paraprakriti, see, that is what is given to us in the image of Kali standing on Shiva. See, because Shiva is motivated, is given life, is given power by the Paraprakriti. So this is in a sense the reversal, you know, of consciousness, in which both mastery and slavery are seen as the properties of being in manifestation.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha.
In Sri Aurobindo's dealing with this matter in the record of yoga, he actually sees this as the relations between Krishna and Kali, as we've discussed elsewhere. And over there, it is as if Kali is considered, he uses the phrase Madhur Dasi, Madhura Dasi. Dasi, slave of sweetness, of the sweetness of Krishna. But Krishna is also a Dasa, he is the slave of the will of Kali. So this is the way in which Ishvara and Shakti are codependent in the Vidya. In this respect, I wanted to also mention another interesting fact, which is you know, related to the yoga of Sri Ramakrishna. As you know, he was a devotee of Kali, and his yoga proceeded in a way in knowing identity with Kali. But at a certain point, he was asked to realize the Vedantic Brahman beyond Prakriti. So particular yogic movement of his, this whole action of Prakriti and Shakti is transcended. And you know, you may have read about that particular passage with his Vedantic teacher Totapuri, or Advaitic teacher Totapuri, in which he denies, I mean, he sort of transcends Prakriti by seeing Kali and receiving from her the injunction to behead her, as it were. It's all to get of her. But after emerging from that Vedantic realization, his statement is very interesting, because his statement is that he was asked what he realized. He said, "I realized freedom, but also realize that there is no place where the mother is not." See, so this is exactly where that entry into the the higher consciousness, into Vidya, gives one the knowledge that this is in fact not a disappearance of the Shakti, but in fact an empowerment of the Shakti. Freedom and slavery are both the same thing at that point. There is no longer slavery without freedom, nor is there freedom beyond slavery, but slavery and freedom are the same thing in the Vidya.
And is that something achieved in the supermind, or is that something earlier?
Now, maybe that is something achieved at the summits of overmind. But certainly the purity of that particular relationship, that those are the relations between Purusha and Prakriti that belong properly to supermind.
So most of these things would by definition be resolved in the supermind, correct? Because then all the paradoxes or all the opposites come together. So this idea of slave and free by definition of the supermind would get resolved there, isn't that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Keka, would you like to read next? Are you there, Keka? Vince, would you like to read? Is it the case that there was the... Is anybody else there? Bindu or Keka or Vince?
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Keka. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. Is it that for the action of a new power to be?
Yeah, that's correct.
For the action of a new power being in a higher range of consciousness, why, even in its control on output, all the principles of its life and a consequent mental identification with the cosmic and transcendent will. The instrumentation of a higher instead of a lower power, that the will of the being becomes free from a mechanical determinism by action and process of cosmic mind energy, life energy, matter energy, and ignorant subjection to the drive of this interior nature. About the power of initiation, if individual will could be there, but it's instrumental. Delegated overseeing.
We can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Did you hear me so far?
Yeah, we were hearing you, but it was very faint.
Okay. A power of initiation, even of an individual, now can you hear me?
Yeah.
Even of an individual overseeing of world forces could be there. But it would be an instrumental initiation, a delegated overseeing. The choice of the individual would receive the sanction of the infinite because it was itself an expression of some truth of the infinite. Thus, the individuality would become more and more powerful and effective in proportion as it realized itself as a center and formation of the universal and transcendent being and nature. For as the progression of the change proceeded, the energy of the liberated individual would be no longer the limited energy of mind, life and body with which it started. The being would emerge into and put on, even as there would emerge in him and descend into him, assuming him into it, a greater light of consciousness and a greater action of force. His natural existence would be instrumentation of a superior power and overmental and supramental consciousness force, the power of the original divine self. All the processes of the evolution would be felt as the action of a supreme and universal consciousness, a supreme and universal force working in whatever way it chose, on whatever level, within whatever self-determined limits, a conscious working of the transcendent and cosmic being, the action of the omnipotent and omniscient world mother, raising the being into herself, into our super nature. in place of the nature of ignorance with the individual as its closed field and unconscious or half-conscious instrument, there would be a supernature of the divine gnosis, and the individual soul would be its conscious, open and free field and instrument, a participant in its action, aware of its purpose and process, aware too of its own greater self, the universal, the transcendent reality, and of its own person as illimitably one with that, and yet an individual being of its being, an instrument and a spiritual center.
So here Sri Aurobindo is bringing this idea of free will to its integral expression. That is, even in the emergence of the individual at its heights, there would be a greater power of control over nature. But this is not happening because there is any certain individual separative will that has that effective control over something outside of itself, but because in that freedom there is a union with the cosmic will and Purusha. To the extent that that happens, there is an extraordinary effectiveness, as he says. Only reason that that can happen is because of its light and vision and consequent harmony. Those are the phases. At first, there is a certain channeling through individual, though separative, perception. That is the light and vision, light of vision. Then there is a certain participation and collaboration, which is the phase of harmony. And then there is a union, which is the phase of identification. Through these phases, the individual will becomes one with the cosmic and transcendent will. Here, Sri Aurobindo in this chapter largely is treating the two later transformations, the overmental or cosmic transformation and the supramental or transcendental transformation together. They are both of such a high and rare nature that he has not distinguished them at large in this paragraph. He is pointing to the way in which both these would act once we arrive at it. The cosmic will is at its heights a transparent medium leading to the supramental or transcendental will. So this is how he points out over here, that this is what the real freedom is. Freedom from the mechanical determinism of the ignorance, whether of mind energy, life energy and matter energy, or this inferior subjection to the drive of inferior nature, ignorant subjection to the drive of inferior nature, this is transcended, but there isn't, as a result, some separative person or separative will that develops command and control over nature. This point is very important. It is important not merely in terms of yoga of the individual, but in understanding the destiny of humanity in its present stage. We are indeed at a certain stage when the universal destiny of humanity, the world destiny if you call it, has reached a point where the image of man, the image of a human being as master over nature has reached a certain degree of completion and also of the realization of its futility. It cannot extend beyond this point unless it retraces or redefines what it means to be the master of nature. See, this is a very key point. That is what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here, that greater effectiveness over nature at this point comes not in being separate from nature, but in coming closer into harmony with cosmic power that is behind nature. Again, this is important to realize that when talking about nature also, there are two levels involved. One is the evolving nature of the ignorance, and the other is the invisible nature of the knowledge. Invisible nature of the knowledge, whether acting from overmind or beyond it from supermind, is the cosmic Purusha whose will can put things in place. See, that is the harmonious order of the universe. And we can come into contact with that through opening the will to that, by becoming an instrument of that. So this gradual emergence of will, not through some kind of independence at an individual level, which is separate from nature, but through surrender to a will of higher nature, of supernature as he calls it, is what would allow this to happen. A power of initiation, even of individual overseeing of world forces, could be there. So here, this idea of the individual is not negated. It isn't as if in uniting with the cosmic being, we cease to be individual beings. This is also part of the meaning of the first of the triple transformations. The psychic being establishes the individual. The cosmic being is what the individual enters into identity with. It is not that in action of the cosmic being, the individuality is either lost in identity or in particularity of becoming. Both of these are preserved, but at the same time there is the knowledge of a certain action that proceeds out of the cosmic in an individual way, an individual center of the cosmic being. So this is how he develops this particular paragraph, showing how in its heights the experience would be, all the processes of the evolution would be felt as the action of a supreme and universal consciousness. So this is where everything that is happening in the universe would be felt to be something one is in contact with or one is identified with. On whatever level, a supreme and universal force working in whatever way it chose, on whatever level, within whatever self-determined limits, a conscious working of the transcendent and cosmic being. The action of the omnipotent and omniscient Word Mother raising the being into herself, into her super nature. This is the meaning of the evolution seen from above rather than from below. In place of the nature of ignorance with the individual as its closed field and unconscious or half-conscious instrument, there would be a super nature of the divine gnosis, and the individual soul would be a conscious, open, free field and instrument. So this is the fulfillment of human will seen from above.
Vince, would you like to read the next one?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good, great. A first opening towards this participation in an action of supernature is a condition of the turn towards the last, the supramental transformation. For this transformation is the completion of a passage from the obscure harmony of a blind automatism with which nature sets out to the luminous, authentic spontaneity, the infallible motion of the self-existent truth of the spirit. The evolution begins with the automatism of matter and of a lower life in which all obeys implicitly the drive of nature, fulfills mechanically its law of being, and therefore succeeds in maintaining a harmony of its limited type of existence and action. It proceeds through the pregnant confusion of the mind and life of a humanity driven by this inferior nature, but struggling to escape from her limitations, to master and drive and use her. It emerges into a greater spontaneous harmony and automatic self-fulfilling action founded on the spiritual truth of things. In this higher state, the consciousness will see that truth and follow the line of its energies with a full knowledge, with a strong participation in instrumental mastery, a complete delight in action and existence. There will be a luminous and enjoyed perfection of unity with all, instead of a blind and suffered subjection of the individual to the universal. And at every moment, the action of the universal in the individual, in the individual in the universal, will be enlightened and governed by the rule of the transcendent supernature.
So here Sri Aurobindo makes it very clear that this is the critical point of the transition from ignorance to knowledge. That this is where there has to be an increased development so that we may move towards the action of supermind. Now, in doing so, he also takes us again briefly through that panorama of what the evolution is all about. And indeed, we realize that the human being, in a sense, is a very complex emergence. It's a complex emergence because we are caught between three conditions. On the one hand, what he is calling the obscure harmony of nature. Nature shows us that it has a certain kind of harmony, right from matter and the laws of matter. The very fact that matter has laws is evidence of such a harmony at the level of brute matter. But it is a harmony which is completely unconscious. It is what Sri Aurobindo calls a somnambulist world, a movement which is not in any way initiated by any form of active consciousness. Though one may question that at its absolute base and see that there is a conscious energy that is dynamically maintaining even this somnambulist world, or at least it puts on this appearance of something blind and dead and just moved by certain inconscient laws. At the level of the animal world or of life energies, so the plant and animal world, we again find a certain harmony. This harmony is what we recognize as an ecosystem. We talk about a world ecosystem. The ecosystems are maintained in a certain way, and yet within that, there is a lot of what human beings recognize to be powers of cruelty, powers of various kinds of negative forces that nevertheless maintain a certain harmony. That's what we could call an obscure harmony. At the level of the human being, we find this subjection to nature as something that we resist, we chafe against the walls of the prison of subjection to nature. Now, that's why I said there are three possibilities of action that open up in this very complex emergence. One is, are we to be free with a certain kind of free will in which we finally are the masters of nature, dominating her by our individual subjective egos, individual human will, rational will, entering into a certain mastery over the cosmos. Now, this has been the trajectory of modern man, and the attempt to establish a world which is a global world, a planetary condition, which is based on such a mastery. Now, at the point of that mastery, or close to the point of the mastery, we begin recognizing tremendous problems. The fact that that kind of an ego movement has ended up creating tremendous disruptions, both in the ecosystem as well as in human relations across the world. It is as if we have built that very Tower of Babel, at the heights of which we recognize, or we suddenly realize our own multiplicity beyond the power of understanding each other or of understanding the earth. Now, that opens us now to the two other powers of this emergence. One is, should we accept nature and its harmony, this obscure harmony that he's talking about, to be the law that we have lost? Is it that we have in some way denied the harmony of nature in claiming mastery over her? This has been largely one of the understandings of spirituality in the modern world. This kind of spirituality gravitates towards the sort of nature worship, maybe of Native American traditions, African traditions, traditions everywhere, that in some way have empowered a certain type of exchange mechanism at the level of universal nature of Prakriti. Somehow, if we subject ourselves to that harmony by surrendering to it, to understand its laws and participate in that, we would return to a condition of harmony. This is one sort of way out. The other way out, which is not so clearly seen, because much of the path lies hidden in light, in invisibility, is what Sri Aurobindo is talking about, which is that the drive to be free is not to be denied. The drive to be free has brought us to a point where we must recognize that there is a greater, more luminous power of cosmic harmony that does not necessarily accept the laws of nature. Many of the laws of nature are to be transformed or rejected. Many of the ways by which nature, in its obscure harmony, has kept human beings or kept the whole of nature trapped, because that is the only way by which it can continue, it's preserve itself, need to be subjected to a different and more conscious law, a law of oneness, a law of knowledge. But such a law can only come if the individual can emerge into union with another larger cosmic principle. This is what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out here. We are really at the verge of this kind of choice. These are the bifurcation points of the evolutionary process at which we stand right now.
So, Vashisha, the first method that you were talking of, the first harmony, so I think that there's a tendency to, you know, kind of over-romanticize the past.
That exactly. Over-romanticize the past, over-romanticize nature, etc. Nature, I'm talking about the quote-unquote world of nature.
You sure, see? The physical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. the natural world.
The new movie, The Avatar, is, I think, kind of exemplifies that to one extreme, correct?
I don't know. I've not watched it.
Oh, okay. So it's something that came recently, the last couple of months. So anyway, what I was going to say also was that in Letters of Yoga and Letters on Yoga and Question and Answers, I think in some places, both Sri Aurobindo and the mother say that this is something that this harmony was lost with the coming of the mind, right? Like with the mind came all kinds of problems which didn't exist before.
Exactly. Very, very true. Yes, that exactly mind creates a rupture, or one may say the coming of the human that we recognize in terms of mind in its prakritic manifestation, but which also is represented by the emergence of the psychic being, which is perhaps also related to the coming of mind, breaks that harmony, the obscure harmony of nature. The obscure harmony of nature is broken in natural form, in terms of prakriti, by the action of mind. But it is also broken in terms of the emergence of purusha by the emergence of psychic being. Because emergence of psychic being in the human immediately establishes a new kind of movement towards the reversal of consciousness.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashishda. So, as I understand what you were saying in this paragraph, was that Sri Aurobindo's solution is not to go back to that route, but to go further forward, and as part of that going further forward, it may be the case that we will discover some harmonies like there might be some coincidence with some harmonies of the past, but it is not simply a reversion to the past.
Yes, exactly. One would also recognize, as it were, which is even what is happening with the mind to some extent, that there is a certain harmony in the world of nature. Now, that harmony in the world of nature, understood by the mind, enables us not to destroy that harmony at levels which are not human, which are subhuman. That there is a respect for that that can emerge, which is what is happening to some extent in our dealings with environment today, attempts to restore the disharmony and disruptions that mankind has worked or wreaked on nature. But at the same time, this does not mean that at the vital level we would participate in that obscure harmony. It means that we have to, in some sense, understand it, but at the same time introduce a new law of conscious being which creates a new kind of harmony, a new order on earth.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashishta.
So Devashishta, if I'm understanding you correctly and were to rephrase what you just said now, you're essentially saying that as an integral yoga practitioner, one can choose to try and live sustainably and always be open for this transcendent movement towards a greater harmonious order. Is that right?
Yeah, indeed. Now, living sustainably is also part of our openness towards this higher cosmic light, I believe. Because exactly as I was saying, in mind's own understanding, there enters a greater and greater respect for the cosmos. Now, what I was talking about when I said about nature in its lower forms, I meant the obscure harmony of nature is something which includes, as it were, various kinds of vital operations, which are, Sri Aurobindo talks about the law of Rudra and the law of Vishnu. These are not in consonance with the law of Vishnu. Nature maintains its harmony through a lot of greed, desire, and destruction. Now, we may be, in some way, sort of, I mean, overseers, or what Heidegger calls shepherds of the earth, in seeing that the law of preservation is manifest in a greater degree in the cosmos, but at the same time, sustainable living is something which allows the law of preservation to rise higher than just the law by which nature maintains itself at present.
I'm bringing this up because recently in Oroville we hosted a seminar, a discussion on integral yoga and ecology. And so in that light, how would you counter the argument that in this yoga we're essentially looking at a transformation of matter? So some people would argue that what's the use of saving the world as it is, the current environmental drive, if it's going to be transformed, or a new world has been formed, is already gone?
Well, the use is essentially that without a recognition of the cosmos as it is, a cosmic power, no transformation is possible. Transformation we people think of in individual terms. But an individual transformation which does not have any awareness, this is exactly the whole drift of the paragraph that he read. The individual who does not come into union with the cosmic ultimately remains stuck in ego. See, growth of the individual towards transformation must be a greater and greater awareness of the cosmic. At the level of the mind itself, it must begin with an understanding of the planetary. That understanding and consciousness of the planetary is almost a precondition. It does not mean that we enter into the identification with the obscure harmony of nature, but it means that we become conscious of the harmony of nature and introduce laws of a greater consciousness into that very harmony. But the first thing is to be aware of the planetary, to be aware of the cosmic to whatever extent we can.
Right, right. Yeah, it is like a pre-trans fallacy to stay at the egoic level and to talk about supramental transformation.
Exactly, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Luis, would you like to read the next one? Are you there, Luis?
Yep, hold on.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
But this highest condition is difficult and must evidently take long to bring about, for the participation and consent of the Purusha to the transition is not sufficient. There must also be the consent and participation of the Prakriti. It is not only the central thought and will that have to acquiesce, but all the parts of our being must assent and surrender to the law of the spiritual truth. All has to learn to obey the government of the conscious divine power in the members. There are obstinate difficulties in our being, born of its evolutionary constitution, which militate against this ascent. For some of these parts are still subject to the inconscience and subconscience and to the lower automatism of habit, or so-called law of the nature. Mechanical habit of mind, habit of life, habit of instinct, habit of personality, habit of character, the ingrained mental, vital, physical needs, impulses, desires of the natural man, the old functionings of all kinds that are rooted there so deep that it would seem as if we had to dig to abysmal foundations in order to get them out. These parts refuse to give up their response to the lower law founded in the inconscient. They continually send up to the conscious mind and life the old reactions and seek to reaffirm them there as the eternal ruled nature. Other parts of the being are less obscure and mechanical and rooted in inconscience, but all are imperfect and attached to their imperfection and have their own obstinate reactions. The vital part is wedded to the law of self-affirmation and desire. The mind is attached to its own form movements, and both are willingly obedient to the inferior law of the ignorance. And yet the law of participation and the law of surrender are imperative. At each step, the transition, the assent of the Purusha is needed, and there must be, too, the consent of each part of the nature to the action of the higher power for its change. There must be, then, a conscious self-direction of the mental being in us towards this change, this substitution of the supernature for the old nature, this transcendence. The rule of conscious obedience to the higher truth of the spirit, the surrender of the whole being to the light and power that come from the supernature, is a second condition, which has to be accomplished slowly and with difficulty by the being itself before the supermental transformation can become at all possible.
So here again, he is raising this whole issue of the instrument. The fact that we may talk about freedom of Purusha and instrumental expression of the will, but will cannot be effective unless there is a willing surrender of all of the instrument. And this is why it is necessary for transformation to take place. This is what makes the whole of the integral yoga centered to some extent on the power of para-prakriti. Higher nature must transform and substitute itself for the lower nature. Higher nature is also identified with the higher status of the Purusha. Surrender to the higher nature brings about not only a transformation of the lower nature, but also the freedom of the Purusha and its union with the higher Purusha. This is one entire line of the integral yoga, what is known as the Shati Chatushtaya. Now, here, what Sri Aurobindo is bringing out in very great force, with very great force, is the need for every part of the nature of the Prakriti to aspire to have itself transformed, to surrender itself to a higher working of nature. Now, he brings out the fact why this is not easy. It's not easy because, again, our nature participates in the law of universal nature, and it is a product of the evolution of the universal nature. We have parts in us that are really sunk in the inconscience and in lower aspects of the ignorance. These parts are habitual. They don't want to step out of their habitual movements. If they are asked to change, they smart under the effort to change. Then there are other parts which are not that habitual, but which are ignorant and which are happy to remain what they are. We find joy in many kinds of compromises with nature. And again, when we were talking about harmony of obscure harmony of nature, many parts of our being are in that movement of the obscure harmony of nature. And they participate in whatever maintains that obscure harmony. What maintains that obscure harmony is a power of delight in nature. That power of delight in nature is of a lower order than the power of delight in conscious nature. But nevertheless, that which has experienced this lower kind of delight wants to keep repeating those actions. It does not wish to move into any other understanding or consciousness of its own possibilities. This is what makes it really difficult. Now, the only way by which that kind of transformation can come is if there is a willing surrender in each part of the lower nature. For that to happen, it must first be conscious of its own law as inadequate. How can it be conscious of its own law as inadequate if it has established either a habitual movement or a movement in which it delights? This is a very big problem. This is the real problem of the ignorance and its transformation. In every individual, this problem is active. This is why Sri Aurobindo is saying that a central surrender is not enough. This has to be a detailed surrender. For that detailed surrender to occur, we have to rely on some higher force to create the conditions under which that aspiration may be built in every part of the nature. It is only when we feel that insufficiency, that helplessness, and can really ask for a change, that the higher nature can change us. Prior to that, even if it tries, we will resist it and we will continue to blind ourselves by the actions of our own habitual and self-delighted natural parts.
You know, while reading this paragraph, one sort of image came to me that it's like, you know, steps, and between steps there is a gulf. So that harmony that you're talking about of different orders, like from lower to higher, everywhere there is a state of apparent balance. And from one step to another, and it almost claims the reality of itself to our limited consciousness. So once you accept, or some part of being accepts the reality of certain state, it sort of, you know, is reluctant to take the next step, where in between there is a gulf, it's not immediately seen as another state of reality.
Exactly. And we find that unless there is a perception of a higher law, there is no wish to change either. You know, like he puts it so wonderfully, he says, first he talks about the habitual parts, and then he says other parts of the being are less obscure and mechanical and rooted in inconscience, but all are imperfect and attached to their imperfection, and have their own obstinate reactions. The vital part is wedded to the law of self-affirmation and desire. The mind is attached to its own form movements, and both are willingly obedient to the inferior law of the ignorance. This is the key point, that they are willingly obedient to the inferior law of the ignorance. And it is only if they are willingly obedient to the higher law that this condition can change. That change of will cannot come about until there arises an aspiration within these parts. That aspiration can only come if there is a perception of something greater and more necessary or more, you know, desirable, or if there is a complete helplessness in these parts to whatever their experience is all about.
Devashishtha, there is a term here, the law of participation, and it's the first time actually I remember seeing this term. Could you elaborate on that? I'm not quite clear whether he's talking about the participation of Purusha and Prakriti in the yoga, or what I need to make of that.
No, here he's talking mainly about the Prakriti. So when he says, yet the law of participation and the law of surrender are imperative, he's saying essentially that the Prakriti must willingly participate in the movements of the Para-Prakriti, of the higher consciousness. Every part of our being must participate. This is like a collaboration in that sense.
Okay.
But the essence of the collaboration is a surrender. Surrender is at the heart of that collaboration. And so it's the law of participation. He uses that term. I think it's a good thing that you bring to notice, bring to attention. Because my understanding of it is this. Why he uses those two terms, law of participation and law of surrender. He uses those two terms because otherwise it is so easy for us to think of surrender as a passive surrender. A law of participation and a law of surrender implies what he repeatedly calls an active surrender. That is, there has to be a willing participation in surrender. That is the condition under which the transformation may occur.
That helps a lot because I was thinking, I mean, the law of surrender seems to be enough, but in putting law of participation in terms of active surrender, that really clarifies it for me. Thank you.
So for these lower parts to accept that participation completely, already there is a need for the light to be in those parts, correct?
Then at the end, the last sentence, Sri Aurobindo again reiterates that same idea of the active surrender. The rule of conscious obedience to the higher truth of the spirit, the surrender of the whole being to the light and power that come from the supernature is a second condition. See? So there are two conditions. The first is there must be then a conscious self-direction of the mental being in us towards this change. This is a willingness of the mental being. There must be a conscious or rather self-direction of the mental being in us towards this change. We must will it with our minds. But then the rule of the conscious obedience to the higher truth of the spirit, surrender of the whole being to the light and power that come from the supernature, is a second condition which has to be accomplished slowly, because this is not accomplished so easily. This is the rest of the prakriti, including all the lower parts, which are, as he says, heritual and in some way prone to their own errors, which has to be accomplished slowly and with difficulty by the being itself before the supramental transformation can become at all possible. We cannot wish it all on the supermind. That's why he keeps saying this whole idea that the supermind will do everything for you or the mother will do everything for you without your participation is erroneous. That there's a beautiful passage in the book, The Mother, where he clarifies exactly what he means by passive surrender and active surrender. And these steps have to be taken by us. Unless we are willingly and in some really conscious way, we can collaborate with the Shakti and make our surrender an active surrender, a willful and willing surrender. It cannot be done. This is also a factor. Not only does it make the integral yoga very difficult and slow, as he points out over here, it is also what makes it completely unique in each individual case. An active surrender implies that every part of every individual must enter into a conscious relation with the divine. That conscious relation is unique, that cannot be actually clubbed into some homogeneous movement of the collective. It has to be recognized in every individual, in an individual way, in every part of the being.
So, shall we, business being past 9:30, shall we stop for today and continue next Thursday?
One second.
Oh, sure, of course.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Keika.
No, I. This is really very important, this participation and surrender. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that this surrender without, I mean, with active participation in present, like at this point of time, what we, though present is not something that can be easily located, but still an effort of sort of active participation in the present. And sort of prevent that, you know, sort of tamasic surrender, I mean.
Right? Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes, it's a dynamic participation, you know, that is involved in this active surrender in the present, as you say.
Shall we stop for today with a brief meditation?